There's simply no avoiding it. For the entire history of the Western canon, there's been a central figure at work, slowly, surreptitiously, applying his machinations and making every single character you've ever read, every fuckboy you've ever loved, hated, hated to love, or loved to hate, do his damaging dance. Kids, we're talking about Satan. Greetings, and welcome to Fuckboys of Literature. I'm your host, Emily Edwards. That's the closest I'll ever get in life to sounding like a youth pastor, but frankly, it's the gist of today's whole show. When the Roman Empire fell way back in 470-ish AD, it was, frankly, because of Lucifer. It's been 1,500 years since European literature wasn't impacted by the fraught war between God and the devil. And one guy, one fucking guy, made Lucifer all the more tempting. And with me today is PhD, culture critic, and self-professed dumpster raccoon, Anthony Oliveira. How are you?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure. My favorite topic in the whole wide world.
I was about to say, I don't think anyone who's listening is surprised that we're going to be talking about John Milton's Paradise Lost today, because you had a podcast or have a podcast called The Devil's Party, tackling the entire text.
Yes, we've finished Paradise Lost. We're on to Paradise Regained, the much maligned sequel to Paradise Lost right now. It took about a year and a half to get through Paradise Lost. So it is a daunting feat, but I love it so much.
Because when I did reach out to you about doing this show, you were like, you've read it, right? Like, this is going to completely suck you dry for the next couple days while you read this. It's daunting. It's a lot.
Well, I was mostly worried because you were like, can we talk next week? And I was like, yeah, it took him basically his whole life to write. So it's not surprising that it is a text that is sort of designed to repulse you. It is trying to shake you loose. Like, it's a lot like Moby Dick in that way. So it is maybe one of the most celebrated and most widely underread texts of the English canon, I think. But so foundational too, which is why I'm so fascinated by it.
It is, because I, you know, as basically my entire literary education has been doing this show for the last year and a half. So I, you know, as soon as I started reading and researching the background of the poem or the work, and then how it influenced a lot of people that we've talked about or discussed on the show, like, you know, Shelley and Byron, and how these people turned to it as a very foundational work and their concept of good versus evil, I realized, oh my goodness, like, we really, really have to delve into this, and it's going to be so much fun. Like, the revolutionary concept of essentially, like, the first couple books of the poem, it's a 10,000 lines of poetry or something.
Oh, I would have to think about the math. There are people who worry about the numerology of Paradise Lost, but Milton wasn't the 666th line and stuff like that. But yeah, it is quite, it's about, yeah, about 1,000. It varies from book to book, but about 1,000 lines per book and 12 books. So yeah, about 10,000. That sounds right. That's a good estimate to me.
Okay, actually, let me backtrack a little bit, and this is going to be fun editing it. Since we do talk about the very concept of this show is like the fuckboys of literature, and it sounds really goofy, and it is, but the whole idea was that there's tropes of these mad, bad, and dangerous to know characters that are gender neutral that keep reappearing in literature. And I think that Milton's Satan is absolutely one of those foundational fuckboys.
Yeah. I mean, even the word Byronic hero, like, Milton kind of invents the Byronic hero. Like, you talked about his influence on the Romantics. A lot of the Romantics are trying to sound like Milton. Like, a lot of Wordsworth's voice comes out of Milton. You mentioned Shelley and Byron. In fact, the house where Frankenstein was first told is the Diodati house. Also, Polidori's, like, proto-Dracula story. Charles Diodati was basically the bromance of Milton's life. And in fact, Milton was in Europe at the time when he got the news that his best friend slash like platonic lover, Charles Diodati, had died. So Milton, in a lot of ways, is the father of romanticism, and then the kind of the fuckboy in general. I do want to hear you theorize the fuckboy as a concept before I want to hit the text, because I feel like there's a few different ways to tackle it.
Because when I've talked about this, and we've really sort of fleshed this out over the short course of, I think we have about 50 episodes now, there is always elements of societal power at play, where usually it's in the terrestrial human world. Right. It's usually wealth, because it's a little bit different when you start talking about archangels, but it's usually wealth. And then title, because we do a lot of British literature. But then also, usually when those aren't available, which is often the case in American literature, it's almost always that known sex appeal. And I think that's sort of where Lucifer slash Satan really comes into play, because there's so much made about the fact that as an angel in heaven, he gains an army because he is so charismatic and so beautiful and so, you know, just like has this magnetic appeal to him, that it feels as though that is how a lot of people sort of portrayed their no good Nick characters in the romantic times.
Yeah. And Milton is a writer who's very worried about the power of charisma. He saw charisma lead people to war, to their deaths, quite a bit. He was the chief propagandist for Oliver Cromwell's regime, thinking that he thought that the, in fact, he wrote several documents advocating for the execution of Charles I once the Civil War was won. He insisted that the king be killed with the crown on him. And his literary figures, too, are fascinated, and his texts are fascinated by the dangers of these people who can lead you astray. Before he ever sort of slithers into the garden to seduce Adam and Eve, Satan has already caused a third of heaven to fall. And he does it partly by relying on titles, as you mentioned, but also his just sheer magnetism.
Does he attribute a third of heaven? Does Milton make that up, or is that rooted in the Bible? It's, again, as someone who's like,
oh, it comes straight out of Revelations. Actually, it says that it says that, although in a very sweepingly metaphorical way, it says that the dragon's tail swoops a third of the stars from the sky, and that's become, through Christianity, that's become kind of a way to think about, well, maybe that means the angels. And then eventually you have some theologians who said that humankind are meant to repopulate the third lost of heaven. So eventually, once humanity's story is done, however many humans there have been will be how many angels fell.
That's an astronomical number of people.
Milton likes dealing with astronomical figures, and he likes the sort of absurdity of heaven. And when God in Paradise Lost realizes a third of the army, a third of his campaign has been lost, he purposely, I've always been fascinated by this, he purposely makes sure that a third of the remain, so half of the angels who didn't fall, sit out the war in heaven, because he doesn't want it to be unfair. So, so I've always been fascinated by the idea. Yeah, right. It's nice and horrible. Like, imagine for the rest of history, you either fought in the war or you didn't. Like, there's a distinct division in heaven forever, which I find fascinating.
Oh my gosh. Could you imagine the politics of that?
Right.
It's like every like Republican senator's like worst nightmare of just like, you didn't serve.
You weren't one of the troops. Yeah. The angels all have some horrible magnet on the back of their car. Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh, that's so horrible. Because it all really does feel very rooted so much in Milton's Puritanism, because that's just, I'm from New England, so.
Oh, my condolences.
I am familiar. Yeah, exactly. So you feel familiar with that sort of like moral absolute that Puritanism was, so entrenched in. And Milton does not turn away from that when it comes to, even though he makes Satan very appealing, very charismatic, the way he describes, you know, the righteousness and the wrongness of going to war on each side, it is so morally absolute that it kind of like blew me away. Mm.
Were you compelled by Satan? Did you feel a certain...
Absolutely. Yeah.
Are you one of
Which I don't know is going up to the fact that I am currently an atheist, or if I'm just like so like biblically dumb that I'm just like, I would totally follow Satan anywhere.
What is it about him that appeals to you? Like, what is this, the nature of the seduction? How has the fuckboy infiltrated your ranks here is what I want to know.
I think, this is probably not something I really want to admit out loud, but normally I am very immune to the fuckboys that I read, but I fell for like everything Satan was saying, which like is really dangerous to say.
Well, it's a text that it's become quite fashionable now to say, actually the title of my podcast, for example, is The Devil's Party. But it's just a quote from William Blake. Again, the romantics are obsessed with Milton. And William Blake said that Milton was of the devil's party and didn't know it. That Paradise Lost in Blake's reading and in a lot of romantics' reading was that actually Satan is right. And actually Satan has made the correct case here, that God is a tyrant, that God is unfair, that God is this sort of high-handed dictator. And the only thing of conscience you can do is rebel against him, even if you know you're going to lose, right? That is sort of the romantic reading of Paradise Lost. Recently, a scholar, Stanley Fish, has suggested that Paradise Lost is a text that is designed to seduce you, that it wants you at the end to realize you would have been tricked too. That just like Eve is tricked, you have been tricked, and Satan has deceived you, and you've been robbed of everything by the text and exposed the moral fraud you are.
Yeah. Phew. Like, thank goodness.
So you're in good
company. Because, again, I did grow up Roman Catholic. So, you have that internal push-pull of being a fallen Catholic, of being like, I should not be believing everything this person is saying. But I do agree with it in that, you know, especially when you get to the portions where he's tricking Eve in the garden, and he's just saying, like, knowledge isn't supposed to hurt you. It can't hurt you. You're not going to die. I just tasted it, which, you know, I'm not smart enough to really suss out in the old language of like whether or not he did or didn't actually eat the apple. But the compelling argument of, especially someone who is currently very science-minded, of just being like, no, you can... There's a line in, I think, book 10 where, and I'm going to screw this up because I don't have the text right in front of me, where just basically they talk about how if you have a little bit of evil, you are fully evil in your presence. Mm. And that, I can't abide by that. Maybe that is because I grew up Catholic, but I don't, you know, it's about what you do with the evil, not that you have it.
Yeah.
And so
it's striking to me that you are the perfect reader of Paradise Lost, because you have you have the New England Puritanism, but you have the Catholic background, so you have the sort of aesthetics of, like, Milton is a strange Puritan. No one reading this would be like, oh, I'm not sure, like, he's not a normal Puritan. And you have the science stuff. Milton, the only person in the text ever mentioned by name who was still alive when Milton wrote it is Galileo. So he's like a very scientifically minded person too. I think he would quite agree with you that the most horrible thing to imagine is this sort of, one of the phrases in the text is stupidly good, that that like a person who is uncorrupted is perfect. And it's like, Milton is completely uninterested in that. I forget who said it, but someone once said that if Milton had been in the garden, he would have immediately eaten the apple and then wrote in a pamphlet about how you should eat the apple. in Areopagitica, he says, I cannot praise a fugitive and cloistered virtue that doesn't sally into the field. Like, I've tried to make a case in my career for the Baroque Milton, the Milton as an artist that is dealing with the English Baroque. And whenever someone asks me what Baroque means, I always tell them to watch the scene in Beauty and the Beast where Cogsworth is touring the mansion And he says, if it ain't Baroque, don't fix it. The Baroque is an, the Baroque is the broken. The Baroque is an aesthetic that is interested in what you do when asymmetries break down, when perfection is deformed. And Paradise Lost is a text about recovering from imperfection, about somehow achieving some kind of restoration.
That is lovely.
It is. It is a beautiful text. It's hard to read the ending of Paradise Lost and not cry, I think. But it talks about finding a paradise within happier far, which is a Christian concept, right? The felix culpa, the fortunate fall, the idea that thank God literally, but also like it's so good that we fell because it means we can have something happier than the awful automaton existence of the garden. But that seduction.
I'm glad you actually...
Oh, sorry. Go on.
No, go ahead.
No. I was going on.
No, but I'm actually really happy you brought up the sort of like the stupid good, because by the time we got to Adam as more of a fully fleshed, you know, person character,
the most stupid man.
I put down my Kindle and I looked at my husband and I went, man, Adam was a yutz.
Yeah.
And my husband, who grew up Baptist, was just kind of like, I don't know what you mean, because, you know, in biblically, he's got a different concept of what happened in the Bible than I do. So I'm just like, Adam was a total yutz. He was such an idiot. He was just, Michael looks him dead in the eye and says, like, you're going to have all of this as long as you don't eat from that tree and everything's going to be fine. And Adam just goes, okie dokie, and then carries on.
Your okie dokie is, I think, perfect. I always think of, I always describe Adam to students as a golden retriever. Like, he's just the sweetest, dumbest man you've ever met in your life. In fact, it's very easy in retrospect to read. I always think lately of Paradise Lost, like Satan is BoJack Horseman and Adam is Mr. Peanut Butter. And it's just like,
oh my God, like, that's perfect.
He's just a dumb, he's impossible. It's the thing Satan immediately detects about Adam is that he's impossible to seduce because he has no aspirations. He doesn't want anything.
None.
He literally just wants to love Eve. It is the most charming thing about him is that he's so desperately in love with her. In fact, he's scolded by the Archangel Raphael because Adam says, okay, but after Eve leaves, he's like, okay, but she's better than me, right? And Raphael was like, no, you're a man and she's a woman. You're the boss of her. And Adam's like, I'm pretty sure she's better than me.
He's literally just like, oh no, she's so gorgeous. Like, you, God made me first, but he perfected humans with my wife. Like, could you look at her?
Yeah.
And it's like, and then Eve is so interesting because she's just like, dear God, can I get 5 minutes alone? And then just like walks over to the tree.
It breaks his heart too. She's like, can I just spend a few hours by myself? And he's like, I don't know, I'm worried. He said there's a serpent. And she's like, just a few hours. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, what's the point? If I can't be free, this is not a paradise. And he's like, okay, fine.
Yes.
But then he spends the afternoon making her a crown out of flowers. It's the most sad passage in Paradise Lost, where she comes back from having eaten of the tree, and the whole poem goes into slow motion as the flower crown he's been making her falls from his hand and all the roses fall apart. It's so sad. He falls
it's
for her, right? Literally, he eats because he says, well, I can't bear to be without you.
So and she describes, you know, sort of what happened, you know, how she feels and how this came to be. And so he takes it because, you know, she kind of urges him and says, like, I can't leave you alone in this sort of like stupid splendor that you have. Like, that would not really be fair to either me or you. And so he's just like, all right. And then eats the apple. And then immediately, what I found really interesting as someone who reads a lot of feminist texts, the first thing that the archangels chastise him about is abiding by his wife.
Yes. Yeah. Adam is uxorious. He's like, he has allowed that the same thing I just said about Raphael, where he's like, you're the man and so you're in charge. He has broken down, his sin is that he has broken down the proper hierarchy, right? When Satan first sees them in the garden, he says, and it's important that it is Satan because it's a fallen perspective, but he says that the gloriousness of Adam is for God, and her gloriousness is for God in Adam. So there's like a very specific, I mean, you want to talk about fuckboys. Milton is also one of history's greatest fuckboys. He marries three times.
A little bit of research.
Oh yeah. What did you find there?
Well, by the time you find out that he's like in his middle 50s, blind and marrying a 16-year-old, right, you just kind of have to go like, okay, that gives me perspective.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, by that point, his third wife was basically a live-in nurse. All his relationships are disasters. His first wife, they get married. She promptly returns to her family, and Milton then publishes something called the Divorce Tracts, which is about,
yes,
which is about couples who don't like each other should be able to separate. And it's like everyone immediately knows what that means.
And he's like, no, I swear it's not about me.
But that's at like, the same time, it's sort of a weird
life isn't living with you.
But I think no one comes away from Paradise Lost without being struck by what an amazing proto-feminist character Eve is, too. She is, as we talked about, much more brilliant than Adam is. She's the intellectual powerhouse of the text.
And as someone who came from a Catholic upbringing, I was actually floored by how eloquent Eve is about her wants and feelings, because Catholics don't get a whole lot of that, even though right. I even like grew up in a very liberal Catholic church. But even still, like, it's not like Mary ever gets to tell people like what she actually wants to do. That doesn't happen.
Yeah. Whereas Eve is so complex and so she's not only aware of her own shortcomings, but she's aware of the shortcomings of the world around her, which is why Satan is immediately gravitated towards her, because they share a dissatisfaction with the world as it is. Like that seduction scene you mentioned earlier is just unbelievable. He says, like, there's no one here who appreciates the goddess that you are, the empress of creation you are. And all she wants is to have more perspective. She wants to understand the world she lives in. Her first speech is about how she says, unargued, I obey, but it's one of the great moments in poetry. Mm-hmm. Like, she says, unargued, I obey, and the line breaks, and the next line is, but. And she asks, well, why is the sun there when we're sleeping? Why are the stars there when we're sleeping? She recognizes the world is wider and broader and more fascinating than just her perspective, and she wants to have it. And Adam's like, I don't care.
Yeah. Isn't it lovely here? Yeah. I got to name all the animals. He kind of has like a 7-year-old's capacity of the earth. And what I found really interesting was also that when they describe as Eve, you know, coming into being, Adam is gazing upon her, and then she actually turns and looks at her own reflection.
Yes.
And which, like, I'm sure modern Christians would be like, see, what a selfish bitch. But it's such an interesting way of her acknowledging the fact that she is a person, which I don't think Adam ever actually does.
Yeah, she, it's one of the, I love it so much. She sort of achieves consciousness in some fashion. Adam is put to sleep, and he has the dream about his rib being taken. And Milton doesn't really like that story, so he's like, maybe it was just a dream. But Eve wakes up, and she sees her reflection in the water. And again, the poem goes into weird slow motion as she comes to understand the thing in the reflection is herself. She says, I started back, it started back, but pleasing, I returned. Like, she recognizes her own value as a person. And when she sees Adam, I always think of that scene from Seinfeld where Elaine is talking about how men are gross, and they're like, their bodies are like utilitarian, like a Jeep. and that's Eve's opinion of the male body too. She's like, oh my God, it's so disgusting. Mine is way better. But again, it speaks to that baroqueness, right? Like it's like symmetry is boring. Even her reflection is onanistic. It's narcissistic. You have to find the asymmetry, and the asymmetry is literally generative in this text. But it leads to breakdown, right? Like, it does lead to, if she had just stayed by herself, which she would have been perfectly happy to do, none of the terrible shit we now live in would have happened, right?
It's true. Well, that's an argument for something.
Well, I have one of the things we do for the Devil's Party is I have like these T-shirts, and one of them says heterosexuality is a consequence of the fall.
It is. Okay. You know, I have to say, as a heterosexual woman, I'm just like, nah, I get it. Totally makes sense.
Especially when you compare it to the angels. Until Adam and Eve show up, the angels are these like non-binary. Milton goes out of his way to say that they can both sexes perform or neither. Mm-hmm. Adam asks Raphael, well, what's heaven like? Raphael blushes because he's thinking about these like all boy, the angels are all gendered as male, even though they explicitly can change. It's like these all boy interpenetrational gangbangs that one of Satan's punishments is he's sort of denied access to sexual pleasure. He does have a weird kind of boyfriend in the text, Beelzebub, who falls with him, that he seduces. The first victim of Satan's seduction is Beelzebub. In the tent the night that God says, here's my son. And Satan's like, nope.
Yeah, exactly. I'm out of here.
it's a fascinating... Milton himself was actually a fascinating queer figure himself. In university, his nickname was the Lady of Christchurch because he had this like beautiful flowing long hair at a moment when men absolutely should not have long hair.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. The army of the force that he was the chief propagandist for was called the Roundheads, precisely because it was so indicative of femininity to have long hair. But he loves to be contrarian, I guess.
The strict binary of Puritanism is fascinating to me.
And the text sort of seems to make it a punishment, right? Like that binary is like one of the things that. One of the reasons we're compelled by Eve is she's like, this isn't fair. Like, she's right.
I don't know what era of literature this kind of falls into, but especially as we've gotten much more familiar through education and things like that with Victorian texts and later, because I feel like that's sort of our understanding of the beginning of modern times where, you know, it's a society that we recognize still today. But Victorian literature is so obsessed with the gray area. And to also know that like early Christians, they saw demons and the devil as sort of excuses as to like why they did like weird bad things. Like they weren't like, if you were a truly like penitent person, you weren't supposed to eat more than like moldy bread once a week, right? And things like that. and so that sort of understanding of demons and evil coming into you really fell by the wayside by the time you got to Milton. And he started, I feel I'm probably totally wrong in this, but he was kind of like the first writer to introduce this moral gray area.
I mean, what's fascinating to me about Milton is that his Satan, it's possible his Satan only intervenes once in human history, and this is it. He gives Eve one little push, and everything that happens after it is kind of just like, I mean, demons infiltrate our reality. For Milton, they become like the gods of the like Greek pantheon, etc. But I'm not sure Satan ever does anything again. His critique of humanity is quite pessimistic. He does not have great hope for our capacity for good, I don't think. Milton knew the gray. He had seen, like, he literally helped get rid of a king only to watch the man he thought was going to be the great savior of the age become just as bad, right? Like,
yeah.
And then he had to watch it all fall apart again. Like, he's doubling the solution.
Yeah, in 5 years, Oliver Cromwell just, like, kicked it.
Yeah.
I think a little bit of history about, like, the actual, the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell and his Roundheads, they basically overthrew the king and in a strict puritanical republican as the time of just power to the people concept. And then within 5 years, Oliver Cromwell died. And then there was the restoration of the exact same monarchy to the throne of England.
And even worse, Cromwell wanted to put his own son in his place. Like, he basically wanted to start a new kingship. Milton, the only reason he is not executed is because he's so publicly pathetic by that point. He's now gone completely blind. Paradise Lost was composed basically dictated it to his daughters every morning from his blindness. But he should have been hanged. Like, he really was one of the leading proponents of the Civil War and the execution of the king. So when you talk about him as an author of moral gray areas, I mean, what's fascinating to me about Milton is, unlike a lot of writers where you read their biographies and it's like, well, they sat in a room and they wrote these things. Milton had his hands on the levers of history in a very real way, and had to grapple with his own guilt in those things, right? Like, that is not, no matter how pure your intentions, he has real blood on his hands by the end of his life. And I think that Satan as a character emerges from that awareness. The, one of the first things when we meet Satan in media res, he's already failed. He's on the he's on the bottom of the burning lake. His beautiful body has been ruined by these lightning strikes from God. He looks at Beelzebub and he says, oh my God, he's also ruined. And he realizes, as he stares at this scarred body, that it is his fault this person is covered in scars. And I think Milton speaks from that experience.
And coupled with the descriptions of one of the archangels as sort of Adam's punishment for eating the fruit and falling, one of the archangels details to him everything that happened up until the great flood. And, you know, it's just kind of like, and that's your gift, carry on with you. But it's fascinating how much time that description spends on describing the fallout of war, where he goes into great detail describing corpses on a battlefield, blood running, you know, in rivers and things like that. And it's incredibly prescient to know that Milton literally just went through all of that. And he's describing hell and the fall in things that he may have seen when he still had his eyesight.
Exactly. And it's not the only description. Like, I talked earlier about how God wants the fight to be fair in heaven, but the angels who are loyal are fine. The angels who fall are subject to pain. So we see these images of them. They can't be killed. In fact, they spend a lot of this text wondering if they could ever be destroyed, really. But they can be disassembled. They can experience wounds. There's scenes of them trying to put their bodies back together. It's really horrific. And again, comes from, I mean, Milton, as far as I know, never picked up a sword, never shot a gun, but wrote the text that made people do those things. And I think that that's why his Satan speaks something real to us when he seduces us, and why he's compelling even after, right? Like, it's why he's a good dictator, is because he's like, well, we did this for a reason. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven, right? It's why he remains such a compelling figure to us, as still a fuckboy, right? Like, his seduction of Eve is... His seduction of Eve is such a perfect combination of, like, flattery and lies and truth and, like, genuine admiration. Like, it is the textbook pickup artist text, I think.
He does. He essentially does nag Eve into making the worst decision of humankind.
He lies. He does say glaring. He pretends to be a serpent. He pretends to be a serpent that is eaten of this tree, and he pretends not to know she's not allowed to eat it. So he's like, he kind of possesses a real snake and, like, uses its tongue to talk. And he's like, look, check out this tree. Look what it did to me. Imagine what it can do to you, who is already the crown of creation.
No other animals can talk, and I can talk to you. And look at how amazing it's made me. And it's just this bald-faced lie. And I actually had to go back and read Genesis, because never really did before, to find out if the conceit in Paradise Lost is that Eve is actually by herself by this tree. But I thought it was very interesting that in Genesis, that it specifically says, or at least in the King James Version, it specifically says she turns to Adam after she's eaten from the tree, and Adam is with her.
Yeah, it's, and this is why Milton plays the game he plays, where, because you get, one of the things Milton is trying to correct for is the extreme misogynist reading of Paradise, of Genesis, where Eve seduces Adam, and it's all women's fault that all this bad thing, these bad things have happened to us. And Milton doesn't want you to read Paradise Lost. In fact, he after Adam falls, Adam has one of the ugliest misogynist rants in literature, but we are invited to read it as misogynist, right? Like, I think. Anyway, yes. Is that your experience? Were you like, oh my God, like,
Yeah, I actually, you know, it starts off with like, you were made from my rib and that's why you're crooked because it's a curved bone. And it just continues into this like really just like disturbing. Okay, after being a woman on Twitter for a very long time, right. It was not the most disturbing thing I've ever read, but it was alarming after coming from reading all the fawning things that Adam had said about Eve, and also as someone who has been on the receiving end of verbal abuse, not to be like too TMI, but like I also know how quickly and realistically those sorts of narratives change in people.
Right, yeah.
So to see Adam go from like, I love you, you're perfect, to, oh my God, you evil whore, what did you do? It's actually very realistic.
Yeah. And it's when your reply guy suddenly goes sour, right? Like, you didn't reply in time and now he's lost. It does feel like it's a poem. That part feels like a poem composed of tweets. It's true. But I think the text wants us to see that that's wrong. I think like it's always the challenge with Milton is always that the most misogynist moment also feels like the most weirdly proto-feminist. Like even the divorce tracts, you're like, you just want to dump your wife. And it's like, but actually this is like a real genuine peon to say like women should have the right to leave abusive men. Like that is in fact one of the things the text says. So it's like this moment too, to me, is like Adam reads intensely misogynist, but we're supposed to recognize, well, this isn't gonna fly, buddy. You knew what you were doing. You ate that apple with your eyes open and you just want someone to blame.
Yeah, especially because I didn't realize this, but I noticed in the poem while reading was that the archangel explains to Adam, or God explains to Adam, that you can't eat from this tree before he's even created Eve. So the warning comes about, you know, and Eve has to learn this sort of secondhand. She's never told explicitly that she can't eat from the tree. But before, you know, the seduction actually happens, she tells the snake, you know, like, God said we weren't supposed to do this. But she's never told outright. She's not given the instruction by God.
Which is her great frustration, right? Like, I guess actually one of the other fuckboys in this text, we have to say, is God, who
absolutely
like, who you want to talk about negging, refuses to speak to Eve. Like, absolutely, she only receives things from Adam. She never gets, she, when the archangel shows up, Raphael, Adam's like, okay, bye, and she like has to prepare them their weird vegan dinner because there's no there's no meat yet
because you can't kill animals yet.
So she makes like she makes wine for them, and she's like, okay, bye, and she like goes for a walk while they talk, and she wants to hear about it later. But the reason she's so vulnerable to seduction from Satan is because she wants that real conversation. It's all she wants, to be treated like an intellectual equal by someone in this text, and they won't. So she's like, well, then I'm gonna do the one thing I can do to make you treat me like an intellectual equal and like eat the upgrade, right? Like take the bite of the thing that will make me your intellectual equal.
Yeah, she goes for the power up, and it's just like, okay, if this is going to make me equal to God in understanding of knowledge and good versus bad, maybe then like I'll get some goddamn respect around here. And then it absolutely, like most women in literature, it completely backfires on her, and you get immediately everyone she has ever wanted respect from telling her how awful and dirty and terrible she is. And it's like, women in literature, everyone, like you there's no winning.
We haven't even talked about Sin, the character of Sin. Speaking of women in literature, what was your reading of Sin?
I think by that point I was just kind of like in it for the ride, and I just wasn't gonna digest a lot of it because it describes, you know, she is the daughter of Satan and has an incestuous son by him.
Yep.
And
yep.
Yep, exactly. There's no way to respond to that. I'm just like, yep, that's it. And the son is Death, who has not yet gotten on his pale horse. And they're just going around basically setting up the dominoes for all of the evil things that happen in the Old Testament.
Yeah, yeah. And also Sin, so she has her father, Satan. There's the incestuous sexual assault, and then her new son, yep, Death, is also constantly producing new children with her against her will. Like, yep, in a weird way, Sin, like you were talking about how women can't win in this text, Sin is the opposite of Eve because she's nothing but loyal to these men who abuse her, and yet all she mm-hmm. gets for it is worse and worse treatment, right?
Yeah.
Like the scene where Satan, first of all, is like, I'm going to kill you, and then has to be reminded this is his daughter because he's apparently forgot she exists.
Yeah.
And then promises her the same thing he always promises, which is like, once I achieve what I want to achieve, you'll get everything you ever wanted, baby. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and she goes along yeah. for the ride. And yet we see her again, subject to this like brutally massage. Her body is literally deformed, as all mm-hmm. the fallen beings are. Every character in this text who falls is like becomes physic. It's where Tolkien gets the idea of like Sauron's body no longer being beautiful and then almost having no body at all. Satan here starts off as this like gorgeous archangel that becomes like the scarred archangel that becomes, he has to disguise himself. One of his seductions is of Uriel, where he hides, disguises himself as this cute little twink angel and is like, oh, what's going on over here, right? Like, and then like a toad and then a serpent, and then he becomes this like monstrous mm-hmm. dragon at the end of the text. It's not, I mean, as much as Satan seems, Milton seems to be of the devil's party, like it doesn't end well for anybody.
No. That's probably, I can only fathom that that's to appease the religious power at the time, because you can't keep Satan sexy, you know, by the end of a text. You know, there always does have to be like some sort of punishment for the evil.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, part of me feels like maybe this is a text that wants to expose the fuckboy for what he is, right? Like maybe by the end of this we're supposed to be like, oh, you seemed so charming at first. Like it is sort of us being experiencing the disillusionment, like you mm-hmm. seemed so great, and now at the end of the day you're just some lazy fat dragon at the bottom of the pit, right?
Like, yeah, like, you know, it's like I feel kind of like, well, you had me going there for a yeah. second. You know,
they had me in the first half, not gonna lie.
Exactly, not gonna lie. And then, you know, it's not until he expresses just his absolute petty jealousy for humans mm-hmm. that you're like, come on, buddy. Like, you're literally an archangel. Like, you fought a good fight. You know, don't get distracted. But he is undone by his petty human-like jealousy for man. Yeah. And you're like, buddy, you lost it.
There's a great William Blake illustration of Adam and Eve kissing, and Satan is like floating above them, like jerking off. It's really, he's just like a creep. Like, that's the thing. You sort of slowly realize, oh my God, this guy is a creep. Like, he delivers these incredibly compelling speeches to the demons in books 1 and 2, mm-hmm. gets them to build him a new capital kingdom in hell. And then he's like, yep, we need to do something to now that we've lost the war. Well, what if we fuck things up for these guys, the new humans? They're super vulnerable. I was like, I'll do it. He doesn't even wait. He wants the glory.
Yeah. Like, and it's like, no, your whole premise was that it's better to rule in hell than be subservient in heaven. So why do you care about what's happening in the weird little middle
exactly.
ground? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
An obsessive ex who like trolling through your Instagram to see who you're hanging out with now, right? Like,
absolutely.
He can't let God have anything nice. It's basically
like
his motive.
Of your ex's dog. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Especially because like the human dust monkeys are just like the dumbest. Adam being, you know, Mr.
Dust
Peanut Butter
monkeys. Oh, I love that. I'm stealing that. That's good.
Please do. Because Adam, who's around for like a little while before they give him Eve, he's just so glaringly dumb that I couldn't imagine. It was hard for me to actually comprehend Lucifer being jealous of him because he's such an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. He, as I said, like, he has no, his beautiful speeches are all about Eve, right? Like, sorry.
That's, yeah.
We dropped a title.
it's going to be a bumpy night.
But he is certainly not an intellectual match for, in fact, he seems weirdly, I'm always charmed by his relationship with Raphael, actually, the archangel, mm-hmm. where it's like just two loyal, kind of simpletons. Raphael gets described as the affable angel. Who he kind of missed a lot of the action of Paradise Lost. He's the narrator for a lot of it, but he's like, he seems to be one of those angels who he was away on a mission for a lot of the text. And he's like, isn't it nice here? And Adam's like, yeah, it's really nice. Like, you get a sense of what the text could have been if Adam had just been like the weird like pet in the cage that is our reality. And then Eve's like, no, like, I want to do something interesting. And that's what breaks the axle of creation.
I was surprised at just how often, I think one of my favorite mechanisms in both the Bible and Paradise Lost is that the archangels are always go-betweens. You know, I loved at some point, don't remember which archangel it is, says to Adam, you know, like, God's speaking to you, but you can't hear him, so I'm just going to translate for you. And Adam just like believes him wholeheartedly. And I think that's something that we discussed in my episode on like the Bible, of just like all the characters and who was doing what, is that the archangels seem to really love delivering bad news to the humans.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It's an old trope that anytime an angel appears, the first thing they have to say is be not afraid, because they're too terrifying, right? Like, everyone is like, oh no.
They're like this embodiment of perfection resplendent, and you're supposed to feel like, I am seeing the face of God, and every archangel is like, nope, believe it or not, God's scarier. And you're like, oh my God, what am I supposed to do with this information?
Kind of the ultimate example of which is the sun in this text. Who is like a very fascinating character for a lot of different reasons, one of which seems to be that Milton seems to be an Arian. The Arian heresy is the idea that the Son of God is not quite God. He is somehow a creation of God, a facet of God, but less than Trinitarian, which seems to be why Satan is so grossed out by the Son, because it seems like there was a period in heaven where there was God and the angels, and then one day God says, like, check out this guy. The angels are like, what? Who? What is this?
Where'd this come from?
And we're meant,
it's like,
I think,
he's my lawyer.
And that's the moment that triggers Satan's fall in this text. He's like, no way, I'm not listening to a new guy. I'm not dealing with new laws. I don't know who this person is. And then dominates them with God's chariot.
Because God didn't really create the angels. They were just kind of like there.
They have no memory of their creation. They have no memory of their creation. They have no sense of, and the text never gives us that either. Milton is playing a very weird game where everything in the text is an accommodation. It's one of the things Raphael says when he's telling Adam, like, I'm going to tell you about the war in heaven, but you're not going to understand it if I told you what really happened. So I'm going to like use these metaphors. So like, like, there's this weird scene where the demons invent gunpowder to like shoot mountains at God. But yeah, so the angels don't remember being created. And that's one of the major points of Satan's rhetoric, is like, well, he can't prove he made us because they exist outside of time. Time is one of the creations that God creates when he creates our universe. So there's no way, there's no before. There's not, until God says, here's my son, there isn't really a history of heaven. They don't have any, and that lack of like pre-existence becomes the means by which Satan can say, well, we don't know who this guy is. Like, this guy says he's God, but how do we know that? He says he's omniscient. Right. He says he's omnipotent. How do we know that? Unless we try to take him down. Yeah. And then he's like, oh shit, it turns out, if he's not omnipotent, he's at least stronger than us, is what he says in hell.
Exactly. That is, I feel like that is such a wonder, that is a wonderful line. Of just like, he doesn't have to be like perfect, but he's stronger than me. So, okay, we're going to back this up a little bit and retreat.
And what a horrible and very human perspective to have, especially in like 2020, yeah, when we're in this like quarantine where it's like, well,
yeah,
the forces that oppress us, the people in charge aren't great, but I don't have the power to put them down. It's like very a Miltonic position. Like, well, how do you live in an unjust universe?
How do you survive that humbling and continue to go on?
And how do you not let it poison you is, I think, also one of the things that this text worries about. Okay, so the world is terrible. Now what is kind of the broken Baroque of Paradise Lost?
That's gutting.
Did you cry at the end? I always wonder.
I did. I teared up, you know, I didn't openly sob, but I was getting to the point where I was just like, this feels so resigned and not quite hopeless because, you know, because Adam, more than Eve, does resign himself to this sort of just, okay, I have no choice in this matter but to go on. So he does, but it's so heavy and oppressive, this feeling of having failed someone by the end, that it's just, I am excited to I don't know what the plot is of Paradise Regained.
Oh, it has nothing to do with them.
That,
no, it
has. Oh, rats.
Yeah, it's Paradise Regained is literally the scene from some of the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, where Satan tries to seduce Jesus. His old enemy, the Son from Paradise Lost, has entered human form. And Satan doesn't quite recognize him. He remembers the Son, and he knows this guy is the Son of God, but he thinks he might be a new Son. So he's trying to figure out who he is, and he's trying to tempt him. And the Son is trying, Jesus is trying to figure out who he is too. He doesn't know who he is. He has no memory of heaven.
Oh, interesting.
It's fun, but it has nothing to do with Adam and Eve. The final image of Adam and Eve is like, Adam has been lectured for two books, like, and then this guy will drown, and your son is going to be killed by your other son, and like all these terrible things.
The tower's going to fall. Oh. Everybody's going to die.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Carry on. And you just have to keep on keeping on is the final image of Paradise Lost through wandering steps and slow. It's this amazing, like, nuclear destruction of Eden. Like, paradise is being destroyed by the angels. The flaming sword of, I think it's Gabriel.
Of the cherubs.
Yeah, the cherubs, whichever one it is like, they're like nuking paradise. And Adam and Eve are just sort of, Michael takes them in his hands and brings them down the slope, and he vanishes. And it's the last time they'll ever see an angel. And they just have to, they go out into the wilderness and they have to find their way. And it's like, that's the human experience, right? Like, you fuck up and now what?
And then Milton's like, good night. Yeah. And then just like closes the story.
Yeah. And because it's like, now it's our problem, right? Like, bad things happen, but what are you going to do?
It's so gutting, and I'm excited to reread it with the perspective that you've now imparted on me, because I didn't know what to make of it while I was reading it for the first time, and now that I have this sort of deeper understanding of, it's bleak while you're reading it, but then like the bleakness at the end of it has been more revealed.
Yeah, I think the bleakness is where the poetry comes from in it. It's sort of, it's relentless. It really is relentless. Like, we're not exaggerating.
It
like, it's literally two books of like, and then this, and then this. And every time Adam's like, oh, she seems nice. Like, no, she will seduce nations. Like, he wants realize his perspective has been ruined, right? He can't even coordinate moral value anymore. And he's like, well, on your own.
Yeah. It's like, there's a moment where it's like, oh, those people seem like they're having fun. They found a pretty lady, went into a tent, started getting it on. And then the archangel's like, nope, she's a whore.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God.
She killed
everybody's
everyone.
Been poisoned.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's because of the woman you love. You're just like, oh my God.
And he still finds a way to love her. That's what's sort of beautiful about, like, we talked about the misogynist rant. And then they have a moment even after that where they like, they reconcile, and he says he's sorry. And then she says, well, what if we just killed ourselves? Like, what if we just let it all end here? Like, we were a big mistake. We'll
close the experiment.
Yeah,
it's
let's
okay.
just end. And they decide, no, like, life life might still be worth living.
Yeah.
Which is the felix culpa, the idea that like the fortunate fall, the proto-evangelium is the, what's amazing about Paradise Lost in my reading anyway, is that God says, here's my son. He's super important. And Satan's like, fuck you. I'm not listening to that guy. What's so special about that guy is what Satan wants to know. And then the war happens and they get thrown out. And then Satan seduces mankind. And God looks at mankind, now broken, and says, I need a way to fix this. And one guy says, I'll fix it. And that's the son. And God says, because of this, you are my son. So it's like a weird time paradox. It's only because the son was willing to die for mankind that he gets to be the son. Mm-hmm. But it's only because he's the son that Satan makes mankind die in the first place, which is the problem of having an omniscient character in your text. He knows how it ends and is cheated to get to the ending.
Excellent point. But there is also just so much in probably not going to use this word correctly, like just the supplication of man willing to admit that they've made a mistake and pray relentlessly for God's forgiveness, which again, as a not religious person, that doesn't factor into my life. But the idea of atonement, I find truly beautiful. Mm. And to just that sort of open soul bearingness of I wronged something or someone that I love, and I'm going to do everything I can to heal it, but I know it's always going to leave a scar, is a truly beautiful thing about Christianity in general, is that like you can insult God and it dings your relationship with him, but you can make motions to heal it. And I think that is a beautiful thing to actually take away from the text, even if it's the gravest sin you could ever commit.
Yeah. And how insufficient it is important, I think, too. Like, even when they sort of, even when they pray, it's like they're doing their best. Like, it's not complicated theology. It always puts me in mind of like, I mean, we've become inured to it, but the revolution of the Our Father as a prayer is like, listen, just, you don't have to worry. Just like, you call him dad and tell him you're sorry. That's it. Yeah, and it's exactly the thing Satan absolutely will not do, right? Like, there's all this theology about like, well, could God forgive him? It's like, he won't ask, and that's the point. Satan will not humble himself. In fact, in Paradise Regained, one of the lessons he learns in Paradise Lost is he takes hell with him, right? He thinks he escaped hell. No, hell is within him.
Nope.
And in Paradise Regained, there's a scene that calls back to when he's punishing Job, because that's the whole text of Job is like, there's this great man and God just ruins his life and he sends the devil to ruin it. And Job's like, why? And God's like, never mind.
Because I can.
Exactly. That's kind of the message. But there's a scene where Satan is literally in the court of heaven again. And even there, he realizes hell is still within him. He's still in hell, even when he's standing right in front of God. Because he won't say sorry. And it's all it would take. And he won't do it. And it's what makes him compelling. And it's what makes him a monster. And I think you're right that like Adam and Eve's willingness to try to make amends, not just to God, but to each other, right? They've done this terrible thing. Eve is quite aware when she seduces Adam with the apple. She's like, maybe it'll be great, but maybe at least if it's bad, he comes with me. She ruins him.
Yes, exactly.
She ruins him on purpose. And there's something so cruel about that too. And they find a way to peace with each other, even though we read them be unforgivable to each other. Like, right? Like, we would be totally on her side if Adam said all that horrible misogynist stuff and she walked away.
Absolutely.
And yet she forgives him even when it's hard for us as readers to forgive him, and vice versa. And I think you're right. That sort of reconciliation is what makes this such a beautiful and tender poem at the end of the day.
On that absolutely lovely note, I think we'll start to wrap it up. Anthony, how can everybody who's been listening and enjoying everything you've been saying, how can they keep in touch with you and your work?
Oh, I'm Mia Koopa on most things, which is a terrible Latin pun and also Super Mario joke. M-E-A-K-O-O-P-A. I'm there. I don't know when we're dropping this episode, but I have like some comics coming out and stuff, but I tweet a lot. It's probably the easiest way to find
name them, because I'm actually very behind on my episode, so you'll be coming out on Wednesday.
Well then I don't know when the comic will even be out, but I wrote with Chip Starsky, I wrote a Emperor Hulkling comic for Marvel Comics that's coming out for their crossover event this summer. It'll sound very familiar to anyone who just listened to this episode. It's about a young man who is incorporated into a war much larger than himself and has to decide what his moral imperatives are in it. But it's a fun little superhero comic and other stuff in
a
few years.
I'm noticing narratives that seem to strike a chord with you.
I only write about one thing, and it's my own ruined Christianity, I think.
Sorry, that probably should not have beget a giggle, but it did. And as always, you can keep in touch with both the show and me by following us on Twitter at @fuckboysoflit, that's B-O-I-S, and at Ms. Emily Edwards. We love to hear your feedback, so please leave a review for us wherever you listen, especially if it's the good old Apple iTunes. And please stay safe, friends and neighbors. We need you healthy. I'm Emily Edwards, and have a good one.
That part feels like a poem composed of tweets. It's true.